Today's Teisho will be on Luoshan, Arising and Vanishing, Case 43 in the Book of Serenity. Luoshan, Arising and Vanishing. Introduction. One touch of the philosopher's stone turns iron into gold. One word of the ultimate principle transforms an ordinary person into a sage. If you know that gold and iron are not two, that ordinary and sage are fundamentally the same, then after all, you'll have no use for it. But tell me, what one touch is it? Luoshan asked Yan Tu, when arising and vanishing go on unceasingly, what then? Yan Tu shouted and said, whose arising and vanishing is it? Verse. Severing old entangling vines, opening up a fox lair, a leopard covers itself with fog to change its spots, a dragon rides the thunder to change its bones. Bah! Arising and vanishing in profusion. What is it? Today is day four of our August Sesshin, and I want to thank everybody for making a wonderful effort this morning. It's shocking to me that it's already day four. It seems that we've just gotten started, and I must say that the more I do this, the faster these Sesshins go, and I know that you might not share this view, but I'd like them to go on for a long time. It takes a few days before people are able to really engage with the koan. You may be able to, at some point, make progress on your koan after sesshin, but the sesshin is really indispensable because, we're sitting for 8 hours a day, and it takes at least a day and maybe 2 days for the mind to become clear and still enough to make some real progress, have some real insight. And then often the koan itself requires investigation, and that can take a number of days. So investigation requires us to be in the mushin and basically internalizing the koan. And this process can take days and days, and many sesshin even, just to internalize the koan. And then usually our big mind will produce the answer once we've fully internalized. So investigation doesn't mean, sitting and thinking, are trying to work things out in your head. It actually means not sitting and thinking, but making your mind, or returning your mind to its original state of no thought and no sensation and so on. So usually, 2 days, 1 or 2 days, just for the mind to grow calm, and then if you're just starting to work with it, a koan, it might take the rest of the sesshin just to internalize the koan. And if you're Genki Roshi, you could answer a koan every day, and that's after many years of practice. But most of us have to work hard in a less spectacular way. So usually a koan a day is a little bit too much to ask for. Right? But if you're like me, you'd be happy if you were doing better than a koan a year. Right? So it took me 5 years just to be passed on the breath perception koan. So it's very important to have patience with the process. You know, I have sometimes encountered people who get nervous because they've been practicing with a koan for a couple of years, and they get very depressed and nervous and angry and whatever. You know. And I just feel like, welcome to the club. You know, I've been there. It takes as long as it takes, but it really takes at least a couple of days just for the mind to get still, and then to begin the work of internalizing the koan and investigating. So it's day four, and we're all working hard as we can, on our koans, and this is a wonderful opportunity. You know, we have more than another 24 hours after this teisho. We have another teisho tomorrow, and we'll end around 6 tomorrow night. So we've got quite a bit of time, and anything can happen. And you know, you could have a breakthrough in the last hours of the session. So it's important to continue now that you've put all this energy into this process, now that you're really, really in a position to do your work. The work of Zen, you should do it. Keep doing it with diligence, because you never know, you know, when your big mind, when your dark mind is going to present the answer to you. One way to think about Zen is to see it as a different form of understanding. Different form of understanding. And I mentioned yesterday that, it's possible to understand intellectually the whole of Buddhism and to feel rather satisfied by that in a certain way. So, it's possible for you to read a book on Zen and to get an understanding, so-called, of emptiness. You know. And everybody's had moments of emptiness, right, or experiences of emptiness. So you could read a book on Zen, and you could say, okay, I kind of know what emptiness is. But it's a different matter. That's an intellectual understanding. You can't really know if your intellectual understanding is authentic or not. You know, your intellectual understanding uses words, and it relies on culture, which is not so reliable, actually. It also relies on your experience, which may or may not be accurate, and may or may not be even truthful. I have met people over the years who've come to sit with our group who have let me know that they're already enlightened. This has happened a couple times. A person called me up and he once said, "Listen, I've been thinking of coming to practice with your group." And he said, "I do Zen Kabbalah." And I said, "I said I'm not familiar with that, you know." And I didn't inquire too much. I said, "But why don't you just come and sit?" And he let me know. "I want you to know I'm already enlightened." So when he came to practice with us, he sat in a chair and he sort of watched us practice. And it was pretty clear to me he was very frightened of putting at risk his own self-image. You know, and I understand that. That's the fear I had every time I worked with a koan, right? You know, this guy was older than I am, and who knows what his life history is. He probably read some books on Zen long ago and never had the good fortune to practice with the Sangha. And he probably got lost in his own mental world, his own fantasies. And they probably got him through, but, you know, he was very closed up, in my opinion, right? Very closed up, because basically he didn't say just come and show up and let me decide if he's enlightened. He let me know I'm enlightened. It was kind of like saying I'm enlightened, and you know, now that we've resolved that, I'll come and visit you, you know. So clearly very frightened, really fearful person. And he was somewhat intimidated by our practice because, of course, we sit on a cushion and we have a very strenuous practice. And he never came back. This has happened a couple times in my life. Now, that's an intellectual understanding of Buddhism and Zen. It's not really Zen. I guess it's an intellectual understanding of Zen Kabbalah. You know, but it's an intellectual understanding of something. Right? Now, I also had another encounter. Well, I could tell you a number of stories. My graduate director was a very nice man named Gary Cox. I don't know if these things get online, these talks. Somebody I mentioned in the Taisho sent me an email and said, would you please remove my name from the Taisho? So I couldn't take it off the tape, but I did take it off the print version. And I changed the name. So I guess if I put this in print, his name was Gary Cox, I'll say his name was Barry Smith or something. When I type it up and put it online. But he was a wonderful man. He had become an English professor, but he had wanted to be, actually at one time in his life, he wanted to be an Episcopal minister. And he didn't really have a deep enough commitment to the Episcopal way, and decided to be an English professor. But he, you know, as he was maturing intellectually, he began to be exposed to world religions, and he had read widely about Hinduism and Buddhism and Zen. And I never told anybody in the English department about my Zen practice. It was just something I wanted to keep separate from my professional life. And one day I had to go to the SIT after a meeting with him. I said, I have to leave now. He said, where are you going? And I didn't really feel like lying, so I just said, look, you know, I actually sit with a Zen group. There's a Zen master here in Seattle. His name is Genki Roshi. And I sit with him. Gary said, oh, you know, I've had an enlightenment experience myself. You know? At that time I was, we were talking about the koan at one point, one hand clapping. And he said, I've solved that poem. I can't tell you the answer though. Because that's not done in Zen, something like that. It was so cute, you know. Of course I can't tell you the answer, you know. And he was such a nice man, and this was so innocent and naive, and so well-intentioned. I'm sure he think, you know, maybe he has resolved the koan, the sound of one hand clapping, but. That's a very advanced koan that requires the person to be in deep samadhi for months, really. I mean, that koan can take a long time. So it's unlikely, it's possible, but it's unlikely my friend Gary had, my friend and very kind mentor, Gary Cox, it's unlikely that he had answered the koan. But intellectual understanding. But, you know, there's a difference between that and what we are here to do at Sesshin. Let me give you an example. I mentioned yesterday that my left leg, my left knee was bothering me. And I said, I just don't understand it. You know, usually it doesn't really. And last night when I went to bed, it was quite sore. And when I got to, it was quite stiff. And I was thinking about it as I was going to bed, and I thought, what? This is so weird. You know, maybe it's because I've been jogging a lot. I've been returning to jogging, and I have arthritis in my left knee anyway, and the jogging makes it worse in fact. So I thought maybe it's the. But then I realized I forgot all about it. But on day two, I was going to adjust the windows here before the evening sit. I was trying to adjust the windows. And I tried to climb over the sofas there. And it was very dark in here, of course. And I'm not especially coordinated, well coordinated. So I was about to, you know, sort of hop over the top of the sofa, and I caught it with the outside of my left knee, and I mean, I really hit it. It was like pow. So, you know, I paused for a moment, and there was no pain sensation, you know, so I just went on and forgot all about it. But that must have been it. You know, I really preened it. And so the next day, of course, it got sore as I went through the day. So last night it was quite sore, and this morning it was very stiff. So, you know, when I came in to sit, I sat down on the cushion after the sutras, after our bathroom break, and I realized I have to really concentrate, you know, have to really do a good job, because I'm the teacher, right? You would be disappointed, wouldn't you, if I uncrossed my legs and went, shoo, wow. Just be honest, be a little disappointed. So I won't do that, you know, but I realize I've got to get in, I've got to take this seriously this morning. So, you know, I sat on the cushion. No, it's just like that, you know. I sat down on the cushion, and it was a little bit like old times, you know. It was like when I was young, training with Genki Roshi. It was like, oh, here comes the pain, you know. So I, you know, I got on the cushion, and I pulled up my leg, you know, predictably sore, and basically I straightened that back. Just like a rent, you know, just got that back as straight as I could, right? And, you know, basically started working with the breath and, you know, no ifs, ands, or buts, right? This is a serious business because I don't want to be in pain and I don't want to move. So, you know, I'm sitting there and, of course, you're watching the breath, watching them entering, move, and the pain starts arising, it starts getting a little worse, and you start using mu, going deep into mu. And when you go deep into mu, the pain sensation lessens, right? And then comes back, and it lessens, and it comes back. You know, like anybody else, I have this pain in my knee, and it's you know, much more than I'm used to dealing with these days. And so, you know, the pain goes away and it comes back. The pain goes away and it comes back. And like anybody else, I think, geez, I sure hope this works. So, you know, what do you know? Like magic. It's like magic, right? After, I don't know how many minutes, because I lost track of time, there's just a dim feeling there. You know, just a slight sense of discomfort far away. And I'm in the zone, right? In the zone. And a deep, empty mind. And, you know, my back is very straight. Because when you start hunching over, if that's what you must do, it's okay. But it's not a good strategy. When you're in pain, you should straighten your back more. See, when you hunch over, the body-mind arrangement is inappropriate. For great attention. So if you're more in pain, you should straighten your back more. See, a straight spine's absolutely crucial. Now, I couldn't do that for many years. When I would be in pain, I would hunch forward. But if you want maximum attention, the body-mind has to be arranged properly. So I just got those, you know, that spine as straight as I could, breathing through the hara, and the pain goes away, right? And, you know, basically time disappears, and I was really deeply in the zone. It's like this wonderful feeling. And 7:30 comes, it's like, great. Ring the bell, and of course, you know, it's difficult to uncross my legs because my knee is sore. But I swear to you, you know, when I got up and walked across the room, I felt like every molecule in my body had been scrubbed clean. you know. It was great. And I have to say, my shirt was a little sweaty, you know, because when I was maintaining that concentration, you know, your body's at a high level of energy, and I was perspiring almost the whole time. But when I walked across the room, it was like every atom of my being was scrubbed clean, tiny little brushes. You know. It was great, you know, and I just felt like a million bucks, just wonderful, right? And it's like, you can't always get it, but it's like victory, you know, victory. Damn, that's good. It's like, the Buddha said, you know, the Buddha was trained to be a warrior. He was trained to sword, ride on horseback, arrows, and bow and arrow, shooting from horseback, sword, he was expert, a wrestler. He was a real wrestler. You know. And sometimes if you read the Pali Sutras, they have metaphors from his military training, because he was educated to be what would be essentially a tribal chieftain, you could say. They say king. But the interesting thing is that, he turned his back on violence and didn't pursue that way of life. But he did believe in something like victory, you know. And he said, there's no victory in the world like the victory over our illusions, you know. It's just the greatest victory. And I don't always have that victory. But when I do, it's just, the whole thing is just great, right? If you can defeat the illusion of yourself, your small self, you know, it's one way to put it, in life. You know, it's just the sweetest taste, you know. So you sit on the cushion and your small self says, you know, move. Are you crazy? Move, you know. And maybe your small self says, you can move a little bit. You know, you don't need to move. No one will know. But pretty soon, if you do that, it's the downhill slide, you know, you're going to start, you know, and basically, when you move, you may have discovered it doesn't really help very much, right? It doesn't help very much. So if you have a pain in your leg, and you just adjust your leg, there's like a split second of release, and then it's back, we're back, and it's back, you know. So a better approach, see, is to die on the cushion. We say die on the cushion. So you know, when you don't move, and your senses are telling you to move, you don't move, you gradually enter another state of consciousness, which is like we say dropping the body. It's kind of disembodied consciousness. And in that disembodied consciousness, space disappears. It's like infinite in all directions. It's the sweetest thing in the world, right? And this morning, I was in that infinite in all directions, right? Just absolutely unquestionable. And it was so wonderful. It was like, damn, this is good. You know, this is victory. You know, my small self said, move, move, move. And no, I'm not going to move. And I watched the breath, and my body began to disappear. And I entered this other consciousness, right? And it got off the cushion, wet with sweat. Of course, it's hard work, but every atom scrubbed clean. See, now that's so different, isn't it? That's so different from reading it in a book. It's so different from talking about emptiness or talking about leaving the small stuff behind. See, this is knowledge with the whole body, right? And so I actually do believe in a consciousness without boundaries, because I've experienced it, you know, myself, in my whole being, in my whole body. So I mean, ordinary people live in the mind, the small discriminating mind, and they trade in ideas and the beliefs, but they're actually not healthy. It's not healthy to live this way, because their physical life, their body life, is very separate from their mental life. So, you know, it's one thing to read about enlightenment, and it's another thing to experience it in your body, in your body. My friend Gary Cox had an intellectual understanding, but his body had not been transformed by meditation practice. And so his mind, his consciousness was limited, you know. Body and mind go together inseparably. And there's a unified knowledge that we Zen people are interested in cultivating. This is why it's possible, you know, to study Buddhism and know all about compassion, but still not be a compassionate person. The world is full of such people, you know, who are quite well versed in moral systems and so on, but they're still sort of heartless and rather aggressive, you know. In fact, I was reading in Tricycle magazine an exchange between two people. One was a Theravada nun, and the other was a professor at some university. And basically, he had made an argument that I thought was absolutely crazy, you know? And I just think purely intellectual, really. I can't remember the exact nature of the argument, but it was like really very theoretical, and I got the feeling this is a guy who hasn't had deep insight, you know, he's just playing with ideas. And this nun wrote in a very good letter, but it was somewhat critical, and she just basically said, it seems to me you're really misleading people by saying this. And the guy fired back this incredible, I thought, really angry letter. And I just thought this is really sad. I mean, this is somebody who hasn't actually experienced very much. He just has an intellectual understanding. So we cultivate body-mind awareness. And so what we experience on the cushion, we may not be able to always give a word to, because sometimes what we experience is beyond language. But we know it's there. We don't always know how to interpret it. But something's there, right? And this morning, you know, mind was infinite in all directions, you know, dropping the artificial body created by culture and by ideas and entering the world body. It's a really beautiful experience. That's what Zen is all about. So, you know, the koan is asking you to have a deep whole body experience, not just an intellectual understanding. And this takes a lot of sweat, a lot of perspiration, and a lot of uncertainty. Because part of Zen training is getting beyond our assumptions about reality, which come to us from culture and from even personal experience. You know, so often, the truth is that what you need to know is right here in the moment, always. The koan is always bringing you back to the moment. But often we can't see the moment for what it is, because of our cultural conditioning and our personal experience. So, if I said to you, please drop the body, you know, please drop the body, you might not know what I really meant. And you might think, you might sit there on the cushion and think, drop the body, that's impossible. You know, I know that can't be true. Or you might have beliefs, other kinds of beliefs that would get in the way of the experience. You might be personally afraid, too, of pain. You know, sometimes we've had experiences which make us very frightened of uncertainty or pain. It can be the case that we've had pain inflicted on us, that by people who are more powerful than we are. And the experience of pain can be psychologically very devastating. Because, and interestingly, it's not because the pain itself is so bad. It's because we associate it with being dominated and being punished and hurt by people who are more powerful than we are. So some people have like powerful cultural, powerful psychological obstacles in their practice. You know, when we feel any pain, we might recoil because we associate it with our powerlessness and being dominated and fearful. And so that's a personal psychological obstacle. But if you dip your toe into the water, you can see sometimes that pain isn't always associated with humiliation or powerlessness. You know, first of all, in the Zendo, in this Zendo anyway, you can take it as far as you want to take it. Right? So I'm not asking anybody to be in agony. In fact, being in agony is an unproductive state. So if you're just sitting there sweating blood and you're in tortured pain, please stop. It's not useful. The useful situation is to be uncomfortable and to be pushing back against your discomfort with your breath or with mu. That's where the work is done. But even discomfort may register as like a horrifying pain if you associate pain with other things, And you can dip your toe in, and little by little you sort of get used to the pain. You realize it's not this menacing thing that's going to strip you of all your capacity to respond. It's really not. And some people have had the good fortune of experiencing pain in a more positive way. So, for example, I used to run track. I was really like a terrible track competitor. Right? I was like talentless, and even my legs are not I don't run properly. You know, anybody looking at me could say, you know, you're on the team because I'm a nice guy and you want to run. But I know you won't win any awards, and I never did. You know. But I love running. You know, I love running. And so I loved being, and I loved being on the team. Right? I loved the team. I was also on the swimming team. And I was slightly better as a swimmer than as a runner. But again, I had my brush with destiny was I went to the regional AAUP competition. And forget what the national swimming AUP, I can't remember, but I went to the regional, like Olympic tryouts. This is like very far from the Olympics, it's like the regional tryouts. And I didn't finish last, so that was good. I was proud. That was like the highest peak of my career as a swimmer. But you know, the good thing about being an athlete is you realize that pain is not necessarily unbearable, right? Because, you know, if you swim, you're going to have a pain. You know, especially, you get these things, I think they're called shin splints, isn't that what they're? You know, if you start swimming freestyle, you know, in our swim club, we used to do like a mile of warm-ups. Yeah, I could hardly get across the pool now, you know, but back then I used to get up in the morning, we used to get up early, just like Zen, and I'd have a big, you wouldn't want to eat anything, but I'd have like a big glass of iced tea, and my dad would drive me to the pool, and then we'd just do warm-ups, and we would actually swim like a mile of warm-ups, and then we'd do the time competitions, you know, and we would compete against each other, and our coach, Keith was his name, would have a stopwatch, and he'd be yelling at us and everything. You know. If you swim hard, if you swim softly, you can swim for a long time. But if you swim hard, you're going to get these muscle cramps in your body, especially in your flanks, you know. And they're killers, You know, it just feels like this, I'll die, you know, and drowned, you know, but you're supposed to just swim through them, you know. So basically, you know, if you start this, if you stopped and, you know, the Keith would go, keep trying, Al, keep trying, you know, and swim through it, you know, and so you'd swim through it and then it would go away and you'd realize, okay, I can handle that. And with running too, you know, you can, if you run like a cross country, you do often like reach a point where, you know, your energy is all gone and you just feel like there's nothing left and you feel like you're just going to drop on the ground, but you learn how to just keep going. You know, there's like a reserve of energy, and of course your muscles get lots of I guess lactic acid in them, so they really get, you know, tired and they feel heavy, and but you know, you work with that. You get through that pain, and it's a very great experience to run, to be in a lot of pain, and then to finish, and then to take a shower. You feel so good. It's just like, it's a lot like sitting, you know. And also, I used to work construction in the summer, and you know, you work all day, and you're so tired, and you take a shower, but then you feel so good, you know. So some people have been lucky in their experiences of pain. So you don't have such negative associations with pain. If you were the target of, say, physical violence, or if you had a bad accident or something, you know, you might have a very different outlook on pain. But the thing is, pain is not a bad, really, it's not that bad. And if you can use it as an incentive, right, to go into these deeper levels of the mind. And as I say, it's not going to be like a miracle. You're not going to go, okay, this is it, you know, sit down, pull up my legs, you know. Sometimes you wrestle with the pain and it gets the better of you, right? It happens to everybody. You know, I sometimes just try to see how long I can sit, right? You know, I've actually done that, you know, like 4 hours, 5 hours, and usually like 4 hours is where I'm really uncomfortable, you know, and this is like sitting without moving, right? And I've never gone beyond that, you know, like 4 or 5 hours. I've never just said, let me see if I can keep going, because by then I just, not yet, I'm going to keep trying, you know. A Deepa Ma could sit for 2 days without moving, really, just like sit down. A Shu Yun could sit for days and days. He used to tell people, Shu Yun used to say, people would invite him to Sesshin, and he'd say, okay, but I want you to understand. He said, I only sit for 2.5 days. See? And that didn't mean I just do Sesshins for 2.5 days. It means I'm going to sit down and I don't want you to bother me for 2.5 days. Do you understand? And he did. Really. You know. So that's my goal, right? My goal is Shu Yun's goal. But I have a ways to go. And as I said, I haven't really tried. I've just poked around. But the point is, you know, enter samadhi. Don't be afraid of the pain. And use the pain to deepen your concentration. And you can do it. You know, defeat, you know, if I get up to 4 hours and I just say, oh, that's it, you know, better to, you know, I'll try again next time. That's okay. You know, and sometimes it's 3 hours and just say, I'm just not going to be able to do it today. Then you go to 4. And then, as I say, a couple of times you get to 5 hours and you go, wow, this is amazing. You know, but then the mind gets tired and so on. So it's, and that's full lotus. I mean, I haven't tried it half lotus and so on, but don't be afraid of your pain, and realize that you know, we have many obstacles to practice, but most of them are in our heads. We have ideas, and they can be ideas about Buddhism, things we've read in books. They can be ideas about reality, or they can be personal obstacles, things from our experience. But don't trust any of them. Trust experiencing the moment. And how do you know when you're encountering something real and when you're encountering a fantasy? Well, part of the function of Dokusan is for me to help with that. But you yourself can test out what happens to you on the cushion. So if you're, say you're sitting and you're working with a koan, and an image comes before your mind, right? Say you see Buddha, right? You see Buddha, and it's luminous Buddha, he's smiling, he's waving at you, whatever. Nice. You might think, that's it, the answer's Buddha, of course, right? But, and you could come into Dokusan and say the answer's Buddha, but you can test it yourself in a way by, if something like that arises, you can just go, you go back to Mu. Go back to Mu. And if Buddha starts disappearing and then goes away, well, probably not the answer to your koan. Probably just a form arising from your storehouse mind. See? So if it keeps coming back, that's usually a good indicator. If it doesn't come back, that's usually probably means it was just a form arising from your storehouse mind. So it should be something that when you're working with a koan. Often it is the case that you will build up a certain amount of tension. And this is caused by the koan gripping your mind and body. So if you're just sitting on the cushion and every sit's really nice and it's all nice and everything's going well, and probably you're not really engaging with the koan. To engage with the koan, you sit in emptiness and you keep saying, one hand clapping, or hot water, cold water, whatever your koan is, then at first it just seems sort of ludicrous, right? You know, it's like, hot water, cold water? You know, what's that all about? You know, I'm sure I'll crack this one open in no time at all. You know? But what happens is that it sinks down into your unconscious, and it begins to create a certain kind of pressure, right? It's like you're taking a test, but you keep getting an F on your test. You know. So this creates a certain kind of pressure, and it becomes like a desire to have a resolution, almost like having to go to the bathroom or having to give birth. You know, it's like you have a powerful desire, but you just can't do it. Right? And that's sort of what people go through when they're working with a koan, right? In Zen, there's actually a term for this. It's called a great mass of doubt. It doesn't mean doubt like intellectual doubt. It means that you're more and more uncertain. And you're deeper and deeper in uncertainty. See? And it's a disturbing, because nobody likes to be uncertain. So a lot of a koan practice it involves some groping blindly, waiting for something to emerge from your deep mind. It's a little bit like waiting to give birth, I guess. I haven't done that. I certainly have gone to the bathroom, but I know what that's like. So it's a little bit like wanting to go to the bathroom, but not being able to. Yeah? Just do your best. Just do your best. This is a real, full-bodied knowledge. It's not conceptual. If you could figure it out on the cushion, what good would it do you? Okay. And the truth is, you know, it has to come from beyond yourself. This is true for Mu. This is true for the answer to any koan. You know, what does beyond the self mean? It means body disappears, world disappears, everything disappears, you know, and something comes to your attention. Something comes to your attention. And even though you cut it away, and you cut it away, and you cut it away, it comes back. roshans, arising and vanishing. When arising and vanishing go on ceasingly, what then? Yanto shouted and said, whose arising and vanishing is it? I love this koan. You know, you could say that Roshan has a limited understanding. Right? Maybe it's from experience, maybe it's from book learning. And he's not able to move beyond the limits of his small self. And so Yanto says, go to the source, drop your body, drop your ideas, drop all certainties, enter deep mushin, sweat on the cushion, experience a transformation in every atom of your being, and tell me, what is the source? Where does all this come from? See it face to face. See it face to face. Severing old entangling bonds, it's like we all have to do that. We have to cut through the karmic obstacles in practice. Opening up a fox lair, a leopard covers itself with fog to change its spots. A dragon rides the thunder to change its bones. Change, right? We're all trying to change. Arising and vanishing in profusion. What is it? What is it? What is it? The goal of Zen is really lofty, right? It's like it's like enlightenment itself, the source of everything. The Buddha said the deathless. That's pretty high stakes. Fortunately, we take it one little step at a time. So to get to the deathless, you don't have to do it all at once. You can just die a little bit today. So sit on the cushion, don't move, and try to get through one sitting period without moving. And if you do it with great determination and concentration, you'll probably be able to do it. Unless you have a psychological obstacle. And then you need to acknowledge that honestly and say, yes, I have a psychological obstacle, and I have to work through that one too. And the way to work through that is actually through the body. The way to overcome your psychological obstacles is through the body. I don't have a lot of faith in analysis. I do have a lot of faith in Zazen. So there's nothing that Mu cannot overcome. No illusion. So please free yourself. Let us all free ourselves from our illusions and enter this beautiful reality.